"What kind of men are these?" Al-Nur asked with wonder, as they sat on their horses and watched the depleted British square form up and march out of the Zareeba. "They have no animals and no water, and still they come on in God's holy name. What kind of men are they?" "They are descendants of the men who fought our ancestor Saladin, righteous of the faith, 800 years ago before Jerusalem," Osman Atalan replied. "They are men of the Red Cross, like the Crusaders of old. But they are only men. Look upon them now and remember the Battle of Hattin." "We must always remember Hattin," agreed his Agajirs. "At Hattin, Saladin trapped an exhausted, thirst-crazed army of these men and destroyed it at a single blow. So great were the losses he inflicted upon the infidel that he tore them from their bloody hands the entire kingdom of Jerusalem, which they had stolen from the faithful and held for 88 years. Osman Atalan rose in his stirrups and pointed the blade of his broadsword at the band of marching men, so tiny and insignificant on the stony grey plain. "This is our field of Hattin. Before the setting of the sun we will destroy this army. Not one will reach the river alive. For the glory of Allah and his Mahdi," his Agajirs drew their swords. "The victory belongs to God and his Mahdi," they cried. As the slow-moving British square climbed the gentle slope towards them, the dervish disappeared behind the ridge. The British toiled on. Every few hundred yards they halted to preserve the order of the wavering ranks and bring in their stragglers. They could not leave them for the dervish and the castrating knife. Then they started again. In one of the pauses, Stuart sent for Penrod. "What lies beyond the ridge? Describe the ground ahead," he ordered. "From the ridge we should overlook the town of Metema on the near bank," Penrod assured him. "There is an intervening strip of heavy scrub and dunes about half a mile wide, then the steep bank of the Nile. Please, God, from the ridge let us also see Gordon's streamers moored against the bank and waiting to take us up to Khartoum." As Stuart said it, the ridge ahead was transformed. The entire length was sown with bright white puffs of powder gun smoke, like a cotton field with ripe pods bursting open in the hot sunlight. The Boxer Henry bullets began to whip around them, ploughing up the red earth and whining off the white quartz rocks. "Should we not return their fire, sir?" Wilson asked. "Clear that ridge before we move on?" "No time for that. We must keep stepping out," Stuart snapped. "Pass the word for my piper." General Sir Herbert Stuart's personal piper, like his master, was a Highlander. His tartan was the hunting Stuart, and he wore his Glengarry at a jaunty angle, the ribbons dangling down his back. "Give us a good marching tune," Stuart ordered.
"The Road to the Isles, sir."
"You know my favourites, don't you, young Patrick Duffy?" The piper marched 20 paces ahead of the front wall of the square, his kilt swinging and his pipe skirling the wild, outlandish music that inflames the warlike passions of all men who hear it. The bullets still whipped around them. Every few minutes a man was hit and went down. His comrades lifted him and carried him forward. The dervish snipers retreated before the resolute advance, until at last the ridge was silent and deserted. The square marched on towards it. Suddenly the drums, hidden behind the ridge, began a deep bass beat that made the air tremble. Then the ground seemed to tremble in sympathy. To the rumbling thunder of hooves, the Bajor cavalry swept over the skyline ahead. The square halted and tightened its formation, and the horde of horsemen rode into the first blast of gunfire and reeled back. The second and third volleys decimated them, and they turned and galloped away. The soldiers picked up their wounded comrades and started forward again. The next Bajor charge thundered over the skyline. The drums thudded and the Umbayas shrieked. The British laid down their wounded and dead and formed up in the impenetrable walls. The charge broke against them, and like a retreating wave, fell back. The wary march resumed. They passed over the fallen dervish, and to forestall the treacherous suicidal attack of the warriors feigning death, they bayoneted the living and dead bodies as they stepped over them. At last the front rank came out on the skyline. A hoarse cheer issued from their parched throats, and they grinned with cracked, bleeding lips. Before them lay the broad sweep of the Nile. The surface of the river splintered the sunlight into myriad bright reflections like spinning silver coins. There, against the far bank, lay the pretty little streamers of Gordon's flotilla, waiting to take them upriver to Khartoum. Some of the men sank to their knees, but their comrades hauled them to their feet and held them erect. Penrod heard a youngster croak, "Water! Sweet God, water!" But his voice was gagged by his swollen purple tongue. The corporal who supported him answered, "The bottles are dry, but there's all the water you can drink down there. Brace up, lad. We're going down to fetch it. Ain't no blackamoor going to stop us, neither." "No stopping, lads," the sergeant major called to them. "Not until you wash off the stink of your sweat on yon wee stream." Those who were still able laughed, and with a new lift in their wary stride they started down towards the Nile. Ahead stood an undulating series of low dunes, the last barrier before the river. The sands were multi-hued, cinnamon and chestnut, puce and chocolate. The hollows between them were thick with thorn scrub and saltbush. Beyond the dunes, along the riverbank, lay the labyrinthine native town of Metemmah. The narrow winding alleys, huts and hovels pressed right up to the water's edge. It was silent and deserted as a necropolis. "The town is a trap, sir," Penrod offered his opinion diffidently. "You can be certain that it is teeming with dervish. If the men get into those alleys, they'll be cut to shreds."
"Quite right, Valentine," Stuart grunted. "Make for the open stretch on the bank below the town."
The dervish harassing fire still spurted and smoked from the tops of the dunes and from among the thick scrub in the hollows below them. Stuart took one step forward, then spun round as a heavy bullet thudded into him. He went down in a broken heap. Penrod knelt beside him and saw that the bullet had struck him in the groin, shattering the large joint of the femur. Shards of bone stuck out of the churned flesh and blood bubbled over them. It was a wound that no man could survive. Stuart sat up and thrust his clenched fist into the gaping hole in his flesh.
"I am hit," he called urgently to Sir Charles Wilson. "Take command and keep the regiment pushing hard for the river. Let nothing stand in your way. Drive for the river with everything you have got."
Penrod tried to lift him and carry him forward.
"Damn you, Valentine, do your job, man. Let me lie. Take them on. You must help Wilson to get them to the river."
Penrod stood up, and two burly troopers rushed to the general. "Good luck, sir," Penrod said, and left him. He hurried to catch up with the front rank and led them down into the dunes. It did not seem that a squadron of cavalry could conceal itself in that low scrub, but as they came off the ridge, the bush ahead came alive with horses and figures in speckled gibbers. Within seconds, the two sides were once more locked in savage, bloody conflict. Every time the soldiers drove them back with those flailing volleys, they reassembled and charged again. Now some of the white men in the front rank of the mangled British square were dropping, not from their wounds, but from heat exhaustion and that terrible thirst. The men on each side hoisted them up again and pushed them forward. The sweat dried in salt-ringed patches on their tunics. Their bodies could no longer sweat. They reeled like drunks and dragged their rifles with the last of their strength. Penrod's vision wavered and darkened with cloudy shapes. He blinked his eyes to clear them, and each step was a monumental labour. Just when it seemed that mortal man could endure no longer, the dense scrub ahead rustled and shook, and out came the horsemen yet again. Riding at the head of the charge was the familiar figure in the green turban. The coat of the cream-coloured mare under him was dulled with sweat, her long mane matted and tangled. Osman Atalan recognised Penrod in the front rank of the square, turned the mare with his knees, and rode straight at him. Penrod tried to steady himself, for his legs were rubbery under him. His light cavalry carbine seemed to have been transmuted to lead. It needed a painful effort to lift it to his shoulder. Even though they were still separated by 50 paces, the image of his enemy, Osman Atalan, seemed to fill the field of his distorted vision. He fired. The sound seemed muted, and everything around him moved with dreamlike slowness. He watched his bullet strike the mare high in the forehead above the level of her magnificent dark eyes. She flung her head back and went down, struck the earth, and rolled in a cloud of sand with her legs kicking spasmodically. She came to rest with her neck twisted back under her body. With feline grace, Osman kicked his feet from the stirrups as she fell and sprang from her back to land lightly in balance. He stood and glared at Penrod with an expression of deadly hatred. Penrod tried to reload the rifle, but his fingers were numb and slow, and Osman held his eyes with a mesmeric spell. Osman stooped and picked up the broadsword from where he had dropped it. He ran towards Penrod. At last, Penrod managed to guide the cartridge into the open breech and closed the block. He lifted the weapon, and his aim wavered. He tried desperately to steady it, and when, for an instant, the head of the foresight lay on Osman's chest, he fired. He saw the bullet graze the emir's sword arm and leave a bloody line across the muscle of his biceps, but Osman neither flinched nor lost his grip on the hilt of the broadsword. He came on steadily. Other troopers on either side of Penrod turned their rifles on him. Bullets kicked up sand or snapped through the scrub around him, but Osman's life seemed charmed. "Kill that man!" shouted Wilson, his tone strident and nervous. The rest of the Arab horsemen had seen their emir go down, and their ranks broke up. One of his agajirs swerved towards Osman's isolated figure. "I am coming, master!" "Let me be, Noor. It is not yet finished," Osman shouted back. "It is enough for this day. We will fight again." Without slowing his mount, Al-Noor leant out of the saddle, linked arms with him, and swung him up behind his saddle. As he was carried away into the dense scrub, Osman glared back at Penrod. "It is not finished yet, in God's name! This is not the end!" Then he was gone. The rest of the Dervish cavalry disappeared as swiftly, and an eerie silence fell over the field. Some of the exhausted men in the British line sank to the earth again, their legs no longer able to support them. But the cries of the sergeants roused them. "On your feet, boys! There's the river in front of you!" Stuart's piper puffed up his bag, and "Scotland the Brave" shrilled on the desert air. The men shouldered their weapons, picked up their dead, and the square moved forward yet again. Staggering along in the front rank, Penrod licked the salt and dried blood from his cracked lips, and the last few drops of his sweat burned his bloodshot eyes as he searched the scrub ahead for the next wave of savage horsemen. But the Dervish had gone, blown away like smoke. The British came out onto the high bank of the Nile and waved and shouted to the steamers across the river. They were pretty as model boats floating on the Serpentine on a bright Sunday morning in London town. They had won through. They had reached the river, and 150 miles to the south in Khartoum, General Charles Gordon still endured.